Hey everyone, before we start today's episode, I wanted to quickly tell you about the membership drive that I am doing on patreon.com/firethesetimes to celebrate over 2 years of this podcast. If we hit the goal of 100 new supporters at $5 or more a month, or 50 a year, I'll be able to hire a producer, which would give me more time to focus on the research and interviews and actually start releasing 2 episodes a week instead of one. If you become a supporter, in addition to getting early access to all episodes, you will also have access to our monthly hangout, in which myself and everyone else who supports this project come together and chat about pretty much everything. It happens every month on a Saturday, and you have access to the link and everything related to that on Patreon. And lastly, if you cannot donate, you can still support by sharing this podcast with your friends and families and leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you get your podcasts. This helps get more exposure to this podcast and introduce it to more folks. You can also follow this podcast and project on YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, Substack, and of course the main website. So thanks again, everyone, and I hope you enjoy this conversation.
My name is Sally Hayden. I'm a journalist, freelance, and the author of the book, My Fourth Time We Drowned, Seeking Refuge on the World's Deadliest Migration Route. It's just been published by Fourth Estate, HarperCollins, and Melville House in the US. And I don't know, do you want anything more?
tell us a bit about your background as a journalist in general, maybe.
Sure, I've been a journalist now for 9 years, and I worked for 2 years as a staff writer at Vice News, based in London, and then I've been freelance since 2016, reporting a lot on migration and humanitarian crises and related issues, particularly across Africa and a bit across the Middle East and Europe. And I currently work as well as the Africa correspondent for the Irish Times newspaper.
Thanks a lot for coming on. As you said, you wrote this book, which I'm halfway through. I already highly recommend it to everyone listening, and we'll obviously get into it a bit more in this podcast. The subtitle of the book, which again, the title is My Fourth Time We Drowned, the subtitle is Seeking Refuge on the World's Deadliest Migration Route. And I guess a good way of sort of getting to this conversation more in depth is asking you, how does one seek refuge on this route, and maybe if you can help visualize the route for listeners if they don't know, and how or why is it the deadliest route? And I know those are already two big questions, so we can take our time with that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, well, to answer the second question first, it was named the deadliest route by the UN, so that was actually a term that's been used. In terms of the number of people that were dying, that was specifically related to the central Mediterranean. So it's the route generally between Libya and Italy or Malta, or sometimes from Tunisia as well. And that's pretty much related to the number of deaths in the sea. But actually, I mean, I think as my book shows, the number of people dying is much, much greater than that. That are perishing before they get to that part. And so I guess in a sense, it's a bit confusing to call it the Central Mediterranean route, because people who reach Libya take long journeys generally before that. And most of them come from across Africa, some even from Asia or the Middle East, and arrive in Libya trying to cross to Europe. So they're trying to seek safety in Europe, basically. You know, a lot of people have refugee claims that would grant them a right to international protection if they could reach territory, like European territory, but they can't get visas or, you know, other routes to actually reach that territory. So they end up going, taking these journeys. And yeah, if you want more information about where people are coming from, I mean, like I said, across Africa. So in the book, I interview people from Somalia, you know, fleeing Al-Shabaab, or Eritrea, fleeing dictatorship, South Sudan, where there's war, Darfur and Sudan, and also from West Africa, countries like Gambia, where people mainly at this point are fleeing poverty, or Sierra Leone, again, poverty, Nigeria, where there's many reasons why people would escape from there. And yeah, and that's only a selection. It's like a huge, you know, huge mishmash of people.
Yeah, thanks. The book, if I remember correctly, starts with a text message that you received from someone, if I remember correctly, in Libya, right? Who I think was from Eritrea, if I remember correctly. Can you talk to us a bit about that story and maybe why you started with that story?
Yeah, so I mean, this is when I started reporting on Libya. I got a text message in August 2018 that read, "Hi, Sister Sally. We need your help. We're under bad condition in Libya prison. If you have time, I will tell you all the story." And so this just came out of nowhere. This just came on my Facebook. I was living at the time in North London, and just read it and responded like I generally do, saying, "I'm a journalist. You know, I can't help you, but you can tell me, of course, if you want to, more information." And so this guy responded. He said he was one of 500 men, women, and children. They were locked in what he called a prison. It turned out to be a migrant detention center. They had been held there for months, and a war had just broken out around them. And the guards who had been overseeing them had run away and basically abandoned them without food or water. And so you know, this came at me out of nowhere. I didn't know that much about Libya, but I actually had a contact who was a Libyan journalist in Tripoli, and I messaged him and said, "Is it true that a war has just broken out?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "Is it possible that there's in this specific area," I named it, "that there's a prison," I still thought it was at the time, "that has 500 refugees and migrants inside it, and that they could have been abandoned?" And he said again, "Yes, like there is a detention center there." So at that point, I started taking it quite seriously. And I started contacting NGOs, the UN, you know, anyone I could think of that might be able to do something, because I was in touch with these people who were literally, there was war happening outside, you know, they were sending me pictures of like militias patrolling in the streets, you know, the sound of bombs going off and things like that. So I contacted aid agencies and the UN and said, "Can you do anything?" And the response came like, "Yes," again, they were confirming, "Yes, there is a detention center there, but no, we can't reach it because it's not safe for our staff to get there." So so that was kind of my introduction to this. And it took me around 24 hours before I started sharing anything publicly about the situation. And at that stage, I had done enough verification that I was sure that this was real, you know, because of course, like these days, you can be contacted with any information about anything, you need to verify. And I started posting the messages on Twitter, and that was at the request of the people I was in touch with in Libya, who were saying, "We really need everybody to know," you know, and I was freelance, like it takes me time to get something published, particularly when it's about a country I haven't even reported on before. So so I started posting these messages on Twitter. It began a very, very long Twitter thread that ended up getting literally millions of views. And I just kept posting and posting, but I started being contacted by people in other detention centers. So I had thought that this was an isolated incident, you know, that this just must be an oversight or something. But it turned out that this was just one of many. And so suddenly I became like one of the go-to people for detainees who needed help. And anyway, to cut a long story short, I started investigating more. So I was trying to get them help, but I was also looking into why are they there? Like what's going on? I didn't fully understand, you know, and there were small children among this group, like tiny children and babies and everything. And so it turned out that what had happened was they were all people who had tried to reach Europe. So they tried to cross the Mediterranean Sea, and they were intercepted by the Libyan Coast Guard, which is being supported since 2017 by the European Union. And this is basically like an effort to try and stop people from reaching safety in Europe. And yeah, this was since 2017. At this point now, I mean, it's developed, obviously, but that set me off on reporting for years and years. And at this point, more than 90,000 men, women and children have been intercepted through this policy, which is effectively aimed at just keeping people from Europe.
Thanks for that. And I mean, since we'll be using the name Frontex a lot, and as it happens, yesterday there was a vote on Frontex here in Switzerland, which I'll talk about in a bit. Can you talk to us a bit about Frontex? Like, how did it come about? Maybe some history of if, but I guess more importantly, how big is it today? Like, how central is its role to what we're talking about?
So Frontex is the EU border agency. And it has basically ballooned in recent years. Frontex is the EU border agency, and its budget has grown like pretty incredibly from around 6 million euros in 2005 to 460 million in 2020. By 2027, it's already begun a recruitment campaign, but it's hoping to have 10,000 border guards in place by 2027. And basically, it's kind of ballooned along with, you know, what we've seen across Europe, this fear of, you know, after the so-called migrant crisis, this kind of use of anti-immigration rhetoric to, you know, propel far-right parties or far-right policies further, and a reaction by more central or centrist and left-wing politicians who, you know, don't want that, but don't want them to gain power, but basically are reacting and trying to keep out immigrants or refugees so that it can't be used in that way. And Frontex, alongside this, has basically ballooned. And yeah, I mean, the topic of Frontex generally is much broader, to be honest, than my reporting. It's also what they're doing in the Eastern Mediterranean as well. I mean, now they're actually trying to position themselves off Senegal, so off the West African coast. But one of the things that I realized, so specifically I was focused on the Central Mediterranean, but I interviewed Frontex, a Frontex spokeswoman, as part of the reporting on that. And what she said to me is that they do implement these policies, but they have like a very clear understanding of what their role is. And some of that is not to evaluate the consequences of the policies. So they are carrying out, specifically in the Central Mediterranean, they're carrying out surveillance, like flying drones, flying helicopters, flying planes. That information gets passed to the Libyan Coast Guard, who do the interceptions. And so then I asked this spokeswoman, like, you know, how does the EU stand behind the fact that more than 90,000 people now have been intercepted and forced back to Libya? And then, sorry if that wasn't clear, they're then locked up indefinitely in these detention centers that have been compared to concentration camps by Pope Francis, among others. And so I asked her, like, how can the European Union stand behind this policy? And she said, you know, it's not our responsibility what happens to them when they get taken back to Libya, because Libya is a sovereign state. So they don't monitor, for example, how many people die after their return to Libya. They only are looking at what happens off the Libyan coast. And so a lot of the work that Frontex is doing, it is seen to be kind of like keeping people out at any cost and kind of maneuvering so that there isn't an analysis or an evaluation of the human rights impact of that. And we see that in the Central Mediterranean. So it's illegal under international law for a European vessel to intercept a boat of refugees and send them back to Libya because their lives are in danger there. But if it's a Libyan vessel that does that, that makes it legal under international law. And from what my reporting shows anyway, there's been a lot of these type of workarounds. And I mean, I would also encourage everybody to look up Lighthouse Reports, who have done very amazing work on Frontex in both Central Mediterranean and the Eastern Mediterranean, which I haven't looked at so much because I was focused on the Central Mediterranean, but what's happening there sounds also completely like atrocious.
Yeah, thanks for that. Sorry, I'm just loading something. Yeah, okay. Yeah, thanks for that. I mean, one of the first episodes that I did on this podcast was with No Name Kitchen. They're part of this network called Border Violence Monitoring Network, for those who don't know. They've been releasing lots of reports focusing on the so-called Balkan route, which is one of the other routes.
I'll probably have them again eventually. But yeah, just wanted to mention that for people who want to look that up as well. As it happens, like, we're recording this on May 16th, and yesterday there was a vote in Switzerland. They have these regular referendums every few months. And this referendum, or one of the referendums was about whether or not to boost funding for Frontex, which is why I brought it up now as well. And unfortunately, 71.5% of voters approved the bill to allocate more. And here I'm reading from swissinfo.ch. Approved a bill to allocate more material, financial, and human resources to Frontex, the European Border Protection Agency that is planning to expand operations. And notably, and they also mentioned that as well, like, that approval is actually higher than the last vote on the Schengen area membership that happened in Switzerland, which passed by only just about 54% of the votes, which is quite significant, because obviously that vote also meant, the Schengen area means that the Swiss also can travel everywhere in the EU, and that barely passed. So the keeping people out of the entirety of Europe in the imagination of many people here is actually more important than Swiss people actually being able to go to Europe as well. And I'm bringing this up because, so one thing that I mentioned this on Twitter as well, there was this campaign, and the way they campaign here, I live in Geneva, is they will have huge billboards and that sort of thing. They also put stuff on the trams, like ads on the trams and whatnot. And there was no to Frontex, and most people in Geneva voted no as well, if I remember correctly. I read them this morning. But there were obviously supporters of the yes vote, as in yes to fund Frontex, to increase funding to Frontex. And the campaign for the yes vote, as I'm calling it, had the slogan, here I'm translating, preserving our security, preserving human rights. And obviously, after reading your book and myself and my own experience, knowing more or less what's been happening, it says a lot that they sort of had to use both security, the term security, and the term human rights at the same time. Because obviously they can't say human rights on its own. They had to emphasize the whole militarization of migration language. I guess I wanted to ask you at this point, have you seen discourse around Frontex, around this specific policies maybe that we're talking about, maybe focusing on the Central Mediterranean if you want, has it changed over the past few years? Because, and for the better or for the worse, because in my view, or at least my impression, is that it's gotten worse in terms of how people, worse for migrants specifically, in terms of how many people in Europe are thinking about this.
I mean, to be honest, I couldn't say how everybody is thinking, but what I have observed, or what I feel like is happening anyway, is that there are deliberate efforts to kind of silence the voices of people who are experiencing this. And, you know, we had in 2015 the so-called European migrant crisis. I reported on that actually at the time quite a lot. And now when we look at that, it was 1.3 million people who claimed asylum in the EU that year. And now, for example, when we compare that to the amount of Ukrainians that have entered, I think as top 5 million now, you can see that actually in terms of scale, it wasn't so massive, or as massive as maybe it was portrayed at the time. But as a reaction to that, then there were so many efforts being made to basically stop that from happening. So there was the Turkey EU deal, which was done first with Turkey to try and stop people from crossing over from the Middle East. And then we had this deal, or, you know, this agreement with the Libyan Coast Guard, this effort to fund them. And alongside that, you have, you know, things like the Trust Fund for Africa, which is actually a much, much broader sum of money. It's billions of euros, which since 2015 is being paid across 26 African countries through a huge range of different means, but basically to try and stop migration as well. So all of that money is being pumped in, like huge amounts of money are being pumped in to try and stop people from coming. There are a lot of allegations that this was kind of done too quickly, in a way that the money is basically oppressing people further. It's securitizing borders, or it's propping up systems that are oppressive and that are making vulnerable people's lives worse, and that actually that's going to again increase and destabilize, like increase the numbers of people who are trying to move, and destabilize the places that they are at the moment. But in terms of the rhetoric around it, I mean, I've been based in Africa for a lot of the last few years, but I would feel that that actually, I don't think that all Europeans are aware that this is happening. I think actually the EU came out in the EU Parliament, I think, or the EU Commission, I think it was the Commission, came out in 2019 and declared the migrant crisis over and basically said, like, it was two months, I think, before the European Parliament elections, and they came out and said the migrant crisis is over now. And so what people don't realize, because the systems that have been set up are making it easy for them not to realize this, that actually that's being done by this kind of like these horrific human rights abuses being carried out, but just slightly beyond the border. And so, yeah, in terms of the discourse, I would like to believe that most Europeans don't realize this is happening, honestly, because I don't think that most people are that inhumane. So I would like to think that's what I've seen my role is. That's why I wrote this book. I just wanted to document the evidence of what is happening to people, particularly at that point of interception, at the point that I perceive the EU as being undeniably ethically culpable, which is that point that people try and reach Europe and they're stopped in the Mediterranean Sea and they're pushed back. And I wanted to document that because I felt like Europeans need to be aware that this is happening, because I think a lot of the discourse around migration, I mean, maybe you disagree, but I feel like probably you also agree, a lot of the discourse is dehumanizing. Like, we've developed this language that means that we're not looking people in the face. We're not seeing what is being done to people, because the way we speak about them is, you know, is becoming more and more removed. And that's being done quite deliberately, in my opinion.
Oh, no, absolutely. I definitely agree with that. I remember, I think one of the first episodes on this podcast, I had mentioned the story of when I was sitting in London. It was around the Brexit stuff. And it's one of those things that a lot of folks now know, like the coverage of the so-called migration crisis at the time. A lot of it were pretty horrific terms being used all the time and very dehumanizing language all the time. And it was very much this language of, you know, a swarm of migrants, and obviously even worse things said time and time again. It's like, literally, it's an invasion. And the term invasion was used in far-right media, obviously, but it was mainstreamed pretty quickly. And as you said right now, like, the numbers were never actually that high. This is something that if you compare the intensity, if not just the frequency, but like the intensity of the coverage back then, I remember this very well while still in the UK, compared to the percentage of refugees and where most refugees are in the world and where most migrants are in the world, a very small minority are actually in Europe. And yet it really felt, especially when I was still there, it really felt like this is the main thing that is happening. It's the main crisis. It threatens to unravel everything. So much of the debates around whether it's Brexit, whether it's the Trump stuff, whether it's everything that followed as well, the rise of the far right was blamed on migrants. Everything was being blamed on migrants. And I mean, I'm not alien to this rhetoric, not just because I'm myself a migrant in Europe, but because, I mean, in Lebanon, the Lebanese media does this. I can see in refugees all the time as well. So it's not like a completely unknown thing that shocked me necessarily when I arrived in the UK, but the intensity of it was definitely something new, because even in Lebanon, it was never that intense.
I mean, even in Lebanon, I think it's one quarter of the country is now refugees, right?
Exactly.
So that, again, those numbers are very different to what has happened in Europe. I think for me, honestly, like, reporting on this, I became a journalist 2013, 2014 around. So I just had graduated. I come from Ireland. So we had like a massive financial crisis and no one could get jobs. And I went to London literally to look for a job. So I was an economic migrant in London. This was my first job when I started reporting on migration, and exactly like you said, these terms like swarms of migrants and all of this. And I was still there reporting on Brexit. During Brexit, I was asking people who kept saying, "We just don't want immigrants here." And I'd say, "Well, what about me? You know, I'm a Irish person. I literally came here to take a job from a British person." And they'd be like, "Oh, but you're different, you know." And actually, I mean, it's hard for me to see that as anything other than racism. Mm-hmm. But the other thing to say would be that I'm not a refugee, you know, and there again is a very different situation for me versus a refugee who has an international right to protection. And I interviewed Enrico Letta, who was the former prime minister of Italy. And I asked him, like, were there any mistakes made? He was there, like, right around 2013, mm-hmm. When the big Lampedusa tragedy happened. And I was asking him at the time, were there mistakes that were made that you see now have influenced how things have turned out and the kind of, like, much greater deaths that are happening now and the much greater human rights abuses? And he said the mistake that was made was equating migration policy with, you know, emergency search and rescue, with basically like the need to save lives, because in his opinion, those things should never have been equated. Migration policy should be one issue, and then the need to save someone's life if they're drowning, for example, should be just separate. That should be not, there should be not a consideration that whether we should be saving someone's life or not if they will otherwise die. And so in my thinking, I mean, that's it, like, it's obviously complex, you know, and hopefully my book explains it a bit better than I do when I speak, but you know, the issues there in terms of people who actually need protection or who actually need their lives saved is like quite a specific thing, you know, and that's what's happening, that those people are the ones who are suffering. They're being condemned to die. You know, I even said it only as very throwaway line, but this whole idea of golden passports, like, you can buy your way into the EU if you have enough money, but you can't if you're a refugee, you know, if you're somebody who doesn't, or at least a refugee who's not rich, because of course refugees come from all types of backgrounds, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I was actually going to ask about the Golden Pass, because I don't think that many people know about this, to be honest with you. I think it got some more coverage in the early days of the pandemic, because we saw some people using their Golden Passports to avoid certain, back when, like, borders were being closed and whatnot. Can you talk a bit about Golden Passports?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert on Golden Passports at all, so I've read about it a bit, but basically what it is where you invest or spend a certain amount of money, and in response to that, you kind of get a fast track to citizenship. And I'm not sure, to be honest, where that's happening now. I know in the past it was happening in Malta and in Cyprus, and arguably in a lot of other Western countries. But there are different types of privilege when it comes to seek safety, aren't there? It's not just that. It's like, can you, you know, that's one of the things that I find interesting reporting on this. I mean, I touch on it in the book. I went to Sudan in 2017, and I was reporting on allegations of corruption within the UN Refugee Agency. And what refugees were telling me was that staff members were demanding bribes of up to around $20,000 for refugee resettlement, which is basically kind of, you know, when they talk about jumping the queue, or like Western politicians talk about there being a queue, what they mean, I think, is refugee resettlement, which is kind of a chance for a very small number of refugees who are deemed to be very vulnerable to be moved from one country to another country. And even the you know, the people who get that option, it's also kind of political, because it depends on which a rich state will say, you know, maybe we'll take some people from that country or from that country. It's not even guaranteed that you can be, you know, selected like that. But what I was reporting on was allegations that this process had become corrupted. And that was what I heard a lot in Sudan. And I published an investigation in 2018 about this, in May 2018, so before I got that first message from Libya. And I then, two days after that came out, the UN Refugee Agency announced they were suspending resettlement in the whole of Sudan. And afterwards, they did find one staff member guilty of soliciting bribes and abusing power. But I spoke to UN investigators at the time. I spoke to many refugees, you know, former UNHCR staff members. They'd all say that because there's so little supply and so much demand, you know, these systems, like, they do become corrupted just because you know, if you have such a tiny amount of something, then it's the people, for example, who have the most money who will find a way to progress in that system. I mean, the UNHCR denies that, I should mention or should add, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that even those systems that you think are, you know, are based on, you know, something else, that they operate separately, actually a lot does come or can come down to money, or at least a perception can be there that if you don't have certain contacts, if you don't have certain, you know, if you're not from a certain type of background, that you might not have that opportunity. And so so like in Sudan, when I was interviewing people, and that was, I found out later, that was why the refugees in Libya contacted me, that they knew about that reporting, but I didn't know that at the time, that they were saying it's too expensive for us to go through the legal route to be resettled. So that's why we're going through Libya, because actually it's cheaper for us to go through Libya than it is to be resettled through the, you know, the legal route. So yeah, that's kind of a tangent, but just for me, it was interesting because then of course you have this idea of golden passports, you know, you have people who get scholarships to study, you know, study abroad students, like a lot in this world is actually based on money. And the more money you have, the more opportunities you will have to be able to seek safety if you need to as well. You know, unfortunately for the people who get left behind.
No, I mean, it's such a basic point, but it's one that really needs to be repeated time and time again. That's, it's very, I'm also very interested in those, like the intersections between the different types of privileges, I guess, that one might have, or like privileges, connections and whatnot. Because in my specific case, for example, it was never really money per se, but it was just connections. It was just like I had a relative somewhere, or I got lucky with this one thing, or I met someone who was, you know, it was actually it's a combination of luck, obviously, but also just connections and family relations and that sort of thing. Whereas for someone else, it could be like having to risk their entire savings. Someone else could be being white passing. Someone else could be like, it's just, and speaking English and or French, for example, would be a main one as well. You do speak in your book of those who don't have English or who don't have French, who don't speak it, or at least who don't speak them well enough, struggling to adapt in one of the EU countries. And obviously, if they don't know Spanish or Italian, or depending on where they live, would be something else as well. I'm something else, and maybe it's kind of a not a very good segue, but in 2020, it's like, I think it was in March 2020, I had written this piece for Byline Times, basically arguing, and this was when there was, it was at least in the news, some of the pushbacks from Greece towards Turkey. I had written this piece arguing that like Europeans have to choose, and this is like a, you know, it's an op-ed, so I'm making kind of a moral argument, if you want, between the idea of a European Union and the idea of a fortress Europe. And I'm wondering, and you know, this is obviously a subjective question, but like from your own reporting and insights, what you think of the idea that Europe has to reinforce its external borders? And here I'm playing devil's advocate, because I obviously don't believe this. Like, what do you think of the idea that Europe has to reinforce its external borders in order to open up its internal ones? And the reason I'm mentioning this is that this is quite literally what has been put forward by a lot of EU politicians, center-right, center-left. Obviously, the right-wing would be, far-right would be something else, but it's, often centrists would say this, and some leftists as well have said this, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, like I am not a policymaker. Like I see my role as being to document what is happening. Having said that, I do think that there's a lot of hypocrisy in terms of the way that European politicians speak at the moment. And I think that it's fair to point that out. I mean, that's not losing your objectivity. You know, that's doing the job of a journalist. And I think, for example, speaking about the EU as kind of being a place where human rights is respected, you know, or, you know, like giving out these prizes for human rights, like doing, there was one in the book that I refer to, they passed a resolution where they called it an LGBT LGBTQI plus freedom zone. And I was saying, well, what about the LGBT refugees who are being pushed back to Libya and locked up in indefinite detention centers, you know, in a country where being gay is illegal? And I don't know, like, yeah, of course, a lot of these things, you know, there's policy negotiations that happen. But again, I do think that we need to be aware of the consequences of those policies. And we're making policies, but deliberately ignoring the consequences. That's when, you know, that for me, that's the big problem. Because at the same stage, you know, if you, I don't know, any state can make any policy they want, can't they? But like, I don't think we should be saying one thing and doing another. And for me, this was really, I mean, I was shocked. I think it comes across a bit in the book, because I was shocked when I got these messages at the start. I couldn't believe that this was happening, you know, and even until, I think it took a year until I met the first person who had been a source for me in Libya. And all this time I was thinking, maybe this is just fake, you know, this is such a nightmare. And I mean, I'd appeal to people to read the book, because then you'll understand what I'm talking about. Like, what we are subjecting people to is such a nightmare. And it's so obvious, like, that it's known among the people who are making these decisions. And it was horrific to me that this was continuing, but it is continuing. And I think we can all see the hypocrisy now. If you're aware of that, you see, for example, after the killing of George Floyd, the European Parliament passed a resolution as well saying Black Lives Matter. And everybody who follows what's happening in Libya was like, really? Like, are you really going to say that? And again, this is also racism. I mean, one international human rights lawyer I interviewed, he said, I mean, it is kind of a system of apartheid, not in the specific legal sense that refers to a domestic situation, but like, we do have a global apartheid situation in terms of what opportunities people have and what rights they have and what is respected and also who is listened to. And a very interesting thing for me about what's happening now with the internet, with smartphones, is that is being challenged in a way it has never been before. So we now have those voices that are still managing to reach people and still can be elevated to a certain extent that are showing us that what is being expressed is not correct necessarily, or is not accurate, or that these morals don't actually exist the way we think they do. But yeah, I don't know. So sorry, I didn't answer your question directly.
No, you did. But you did. I mean, we can talk about this example that you just mentioned as well. Like, I actually wrote it down because it's just so, I mean, it's just so indicative of what we're talking about, right? Like, so towards the end of the book, you had the story of Ade, I guess would be how I pronounce the name, if that's right, who's a gay Somali teenager who fled his home after, quote, hearing family members say it is necessary to torture LGBT plus people until they turn straight, end quote. Published up with a trigger warning there, but it's okay. He registered with UN staff in Libya, but he didn't tell them he was gay because he was scared of the homophobia Libyan authorities. He is obviously from the book. And here we should bring up the fact that the UN doesn't seem to be doing much to alleviate these justified fears as well. At least that's my impression. But so, okay, then he manages to sail to Malta in 2019 alongside 229 others on a wooden boat. And while Aden was in Malta, and did I understand correctly that he's still there? I mean, as far as we know.
No, he's in Brussels now.
Okay, amazing. Okay, I probably missed that, sorry.
I'm not sure. I think it was in the book, but I'm not certain, actually.
Okay, well.
It might have happened after, sorry, because okay. Things have moved a little bit.
Sure, yeah. So while he was in Malta, which was here 2019, two things happened at the same time. There was a protest, many protests, but there was one protest in memory of Daphne Galizia, who is this independent journalist who was assassinated in 2017. And at the same time, the EU declared itself, as you said, an LGBTIA freedom zone. Galizia investigated, among other things, which is relevant to what we're talking about, the so-called golden passports, as we mentioned before, that very rich people can essentially buy and become Maltese and therefore become EU citizens. And I appreciate how you juxtapose these three things, because that's one of the ways, like, you know, show, don't tell, essentially. And we know that Aden being gay was no protection in his so-called LGBTI freedom zone. But we also know that if he did have those supposedly 650,000 euros at the time, he could have gotten this passport and so on. And that you can get a very clear idea, very obvious evidence or proof, if you want, that essentially if he had money, you know, he wouldn't have had the problems that he had. And so, which defeats the entire point, obviously, of a right to asylum. If it was a right, you shouldn't be come with like come conditions and, you know, that sort of thing. So, I mean, you already spoken about it, but I was wondering if you can maybe use this as a reference to talk about something else, and maybe let me think about this, how to ask this question. Okay. So given that in his story, it's so stark, essentially, like, you know, obviously this is not an LGBTIA free zone. Another example is the one that you mentioned before, which is that, yes, that now there are, I actually don't even know how many, 4 or 5 million Ukrainians who are refugees in Europe. And obviously that's, I'm totally fine with that. I support everyone's right to claim, you know, safety and whatnot anywhere. But it does obviously show the very obvious contrast. And I say this as not just as an Arab migrant or whatever, what have you, in Europe, but I'm also doing a Ukraine series with a Ukrainian journalist on this podcast. And one of the topics that we haven't yet decided when yet will be on this, like, when is a refugee crisis a refugee crisis? Who gets to decide when to apply the term crisis? Because if it was a refugee crisis in 2015 or whatnot, obviously what's happening now is a refugee crisis, and yet it's not. I read the news every other day. It's not in the headlines. It's not something that people are debating. It's not that there are no characterization of swarms, as far as I can tell. No one is stealing our jobs. You know, it's none of that is happening. Actually, one of my fears is that the welcome, because of the previous bad experience that we've seen in 2015, the welcome might actually dry out eventually. And mm-hmm. I am concerned about that for Ukrainian refugees as well. I guess just a general discussion on this, if you don't mind.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm also concerned about that. It's like I finished the book before the Ukraine war started. And of course, like, it's absolutely horrific what is happening. And yeah, in some ways, it was like quite shocking and also kind of like a little bit heartening to see how mm-hmm. refugees from Ukraine were welcomed, because we have, like, there's been years where I never thought that would have been possible for anyone. And now suddenly it is happening. And, you know, even I'm from Ireland, like, I have family members, I have friends who are all getting involved in kind of responses to try and help Ukrainians. And that's like amazing to see. It's also like depressing because I think there is a question. We saw this in the media coverage. We saw this about how people were spoken about, like they were saying, you know, these are educated people, these are civilized people, they are, you know, they're just like us. And there were, you know, there are big issues about that, aren't there? Because first of all, like, I know from reporting on refugee situations in other countries that there are many educated people. You know, in Libya, I was in touch with musicians, with medics, with IT programmers, with lecturers, former lecturers, dentists. You know, everyone that you can imagine has ended up there because they don't have other options. And I spoke to a former source who's now in Sweden but was in Libya for a few years, and he was just saying that it's racism, in his opinion, that it's about the color of people's skin. I mean, I don't know that it's that simple, but I also think that some of it, like, then we had this discussion, you know, well, Ukraine, people would say, well, Ukraine has a shared history with us. But I mean, I would argue that a lot of African countries are former European colonies, you know, so they have a very direct shared history with Europe. And then another question is, like, what we were talking about earlier, this idea of dehumanization, and how has the language that we've been using, and of course, as a journalist, I have to reckon with myself on this too, how has the language that we've been using made it easier for people not to associate or not to see themselves in African refugees, for example? Like, and actually, have we contributed to that, or how has that been contributed to? And one of the things that I look at in the book was this use of jargon, the use of language, and, you know, even the fact that the European Union is now funding trainings for journalists that teach them certain types, certain uses of language around migration across West Africa, and, you know, how those terms are being applied. And I mean, this is a slight tangent, but one of the things that I got challenged when I reported on this, I honestly, like, what I had taught before and what I taught afterwards changes quite a lot. And I looked at this term economic migrants. I went to Sierra Leone to meet, there was a guy called Joseph who was in detention, and he was messaging me from detention. He wasn't considered as a refugee. He couldn't be taken for evacuation. He was from Sierra Leone, and basically the only way for him to get out of detention was to be sent back to Sierra Leone through an EU funded program with the IOM, the International Organization for Migration. So eventually he asked me, like, can he go on this program? And I contacted IOM for him, and they ended up bringing him back to Sierra Leone. And I went to meet him there, and I ended up staying there for quite a long time, like on and off for a year, not just because of him, but just for various reasons to do with where I was working from. And and what I learned about Sierra Leone, it's one of the poorest countries in the world. I think 10% of children die before the age of 5. If it's one of the most dangerous places to give birth as a woman. I was there during COVID, and there were no ventilators functioning, like, in the whole country. So if you got COVID and you needed a ventilator, you just would die. And the life expectancy is, I think, 26 years less than a European. And so when I started learning about all of these things, I realized, you know, that, you know, even this term economic migrant, it makes it sound like people are going looking for money, you know, and money we would think of as money as being like discretionary spending, you know, spending on luxury or whatever. But actually, that can just mean healthcare, you know, that could mean that people need food or need healthcare or need, you know, something that will prolong their life for a little bit more. And when you look at it like that, for me, it made the kind of idea of a threat to life also seem quite different than I had thought about it before. And so, again, this term economic migrant, even, I think that can be challenged. But of course, there's like legal definitions for these things. But when, you know, I don't know, for me, when I hear, sorry, this is a long answer, but when I hear somebody who I know say, you know, but that person isn't like me, I'm like, well, what are the structures or what are the systems or what even is the words that you're using and the thoughts in your head that mean that you don't see that person as like you? Yeah. And sorry, one other thing. I mean, this is also why I wrote the book, because a lot of my sources, I couldn't publish information about their identities at the time because of security problems for them, because they were literally inside detention. So if I publish anything, you know, that could be incredibly dangerous for them. And those threats were very, very real. But I was also aware that I felt I was contributing to this dehumanization by publishing reports without any details about the humanity of a person inside them. And that was why I wanted to do a book as well, to make sure that you can actually like see a bit more about the backgrounds of those people, because otherwise it is much easier to disengage, I think.
No, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. And I mean, again, I mentioned this in the beginning, but it is generally a really good book. I mean, obviously, I would say this to all my guests, so people think I'm not being honest, but I do genuinely mean this. I mean, otherwise, I wouldn't have invited you, right? So one kind of a final, well-ish final point. So one of the persons that you interviewed, Eritrean, I believe, he told you this, and here I'm quoting: "One day I will reach Europe and we will meet. And if it doesn't happen, I want you to write a book which tells my story, because the world's people need to read the story for their enjoyment," end quote. And this is, you know, I've worked as a journalist in the past. I've had a lot of journalists on the podcast as well. And I do know that we tend to have a tendency of not wanting to talk about how we deal with the stories that we cover, because especially if the stories that we're covering are like very, very difficult ones, we don't want to make this about us or whatnot. But if it's okay, like, I do wonder in these situations, like, how do you cope with stories like this one and the many stories that you have written about? Just that. How do you cope in a very, very broad way?
I mean, I think for me, to be honest, the first year that I reported on this was very, very difficult because, like I said, what happened was my number got passed around, or my contact details were passed around a lot of different detention centers. And so I became kind of like the go-to person for many people whenever there was a crisis situation. And a lot of that meant that I had to be looking at my phone all the time, and also particularly at nighttime. So because people were hiding, you're not allowed to have phones in a lot of these detention centers. So the only time that people could message was late at night, you know, when it was dark, they'd put a blanket over themselves and they'd message under the blanket. And so it would get to like 11, maybe 12. And suddenly my phone would start lighting up and I'd be up for like 3 hours, maybe just messaging people, collecting the information. And for me, it was quite shocking that there wasn't. And I actually did an event recently with a former UNHCR staff member who's now an academic. And she was saying as well that there wasn't a means for people to, for the refugees in detention to directly contact anyone else. That literally hadn't been set up. And that was why it became me. I mean, it wasn't that I was, you know, particularly great or anything like that. It wasn't even my role. I didn't imagine that I'd be gathering information to pass on to aid agencies to ask people for help. But there just wasn't a system there where people could contact somebody directly. And so, yeah, it was really hard. Like that year, I missed everything. I ended up, I couldn't go out. You know, I was anxious when I had no internet. I wanted to make sure that I was always in communication. If I got on a plane, I'd panic. There's a scene in the book where I weirdly got brought out to Tunisia to get an award from the European Union. And I had no internet. We had to do this award ceremony and there was no internet. And I was panicking because I was wondering, you know, maybe something is happening to these to the guys in Libya and nobody's gonna know about it. And so that, I mean, initially that was the problem, but then, and I talk about this in the book as well, the thing that then started making me very uncomfortable was that I started to be awarded. And so there was a few months where I reported on this and then I started being given awards for my work. And that was, you know, in one sense, you want to highlight that something is happening, so you think that that's good. But in another, it's like me as a privileged white person to then have the focus put on me rather than this broader situation, which you're like kind of desperately trying to get people to listen to. And more than me, like the people in detention were risking everything to try and get people to pay attention to this. And instead, it's me that gets fated, you know, or me that gets offered things, or me that gets, you know, invited places and flown around. And I think mentally that was like very strange. And one thing I'm trying to do now, I mean, I don't write about it so much in the book, but now that it's published, I want to try find more ways to help people who want to. I mean, they don't have to, but people who want to tell their own stories to do that, because I think as journalists, we always have to question, you know, of course, it's good to compile information and to share it and all of this, but you can't, you know, it really damages you mentally as well as everything else for it to be absolutely. Like that there's focus on you instead of the issue. And also, I don't think, you know, I think you can, go a bit insane if you forget about that, if you forget about why you're doing it, you know. Mm-hmm.
No, I definitely sympathize with that. I don't know. For me, there isn't, I guess there isn't a, because at the end of the day, like if you found yourself in a situation where obviously you definitely felt like a moral duty to continue what you were doing. And at the same time, like it shouldn't be up to one journalist to be the one connecting everyone. And, you know, there should be structures to do that in the first place, so that, like the fact that you had to kind of compensate in some sense is in and of itself a problem.
I should say there are other journalists that have reported on this. I think I specifically was doing, my reporting got a lot of attention, but like I said, I kind of came out of nowhere because I wasn't following the situation until I started being contacted. And then because I started that Twitter thread and it like went viral or however you'd say, so it ended up getting millions of views, and suddenly I was like being contacted by more and more people. So I had kind of like this rush of information, but there were other people who had also been either reporting on it or trying to report on it. And that's, you know, obviously human rights groups as well have done various reports. I think the other thing, sorry, that I would say, just when you're talking about my experience specifically, it became pretty clear pretty early that I had, you know, hit on a hot button topic or whatever. And I detailed that a bit in the book. I didn't want to make a big deal out of it, but like I did face death threats and I also was under criminal investigation then for a year. And the thing that I would say about that was that honestly, it did have a chilling effect. Like I became scared to publish things. And that was what I, you know, after now I look back and I say I should have kept going. I should have actually been publishing all that time. But I mean, I would lie if I said that I didn't. You know, I lost a lot of motivation when that started happening because I didn't know where the threats specifically were coming from. I didn't know how much danger I was in and how seriously to take things. And they also curtailed how much I could travel. And then, you know, when you're kind of facing that, you do become very... very paranoid. And the only the reason that's important is just because it does actually affect the amount that you can report or that you produce. And I did feel like bad about that afterwards.
No, absolutely. Is there anything that you wanted to talk about and that I didn't ask or I forgot or you wanted to kind of expand a bit more on?
I mean, I think it's just good to reemphasize like the bravery of the people in detention. So the book, I mean, I don't know if I did this perfectly, but the book, I decided pretty early on I wanted to have direct voices of people so that you can hear them directly. And so that's the book is kind of interspersed with direct messages from people who were inside detention centers. And I don't think it can be emphasized enough. Like that was them literally risking their lives in some cases to get that information out. And I'm just astounded by that level of bravery and the fact that, you know, this evidence is coming from them basically. So I don't know.
No, yeah.
And the other thing, sorry, that I would say in terms of if people want to read the book, it's not just like a list of, I know, basically sales like can be hard when, not that it's about sales, but like getting people to read something can be hard when they think it's very just sad, you know? And I tried to write it in a way that it's not like a list of just, you know, human rights abuses. I mean, they're there, but I tried to also add, you know, details about just life in detention generally, just like things that people would say that were funny, you know, just every the ways that people survive, you know. And that was fascinating to me as well, the fact that people can survive in these horrific conditions and still keep a sense of humor, for example. And I tried to put in a bit of that. I don't know how much I succeeded, but
I thought
it would have been unfair just to make it sound like everybody's just, you know, constantly suffering all the time.
No, of course. I mean, yeah, and doing so, like if like that's part of the dehumanization process as well. At the end of the day, people in various situations manage to thrive, if at the very least to survive, and not everyone loses their humor. Some people cope with humor. There's a reason why, like in the region, like in the Middle East, we have a lot of dark humor. It's part of the coping mechanisms as well. So no, it does come across in the book. I can definitely say that. As I say, I'm like halfway through. So, I mean, speaking of books, obviously. Before asking you for three books, I will briefly mention that there's another book called Ciao Osman, The Hidden Exploitation of Italy's Migrant Worker by Xiao Hong Pai, who will hopefully be a guest soon. She confirmed, but we don't have a date yet. Which is also a book that it reminded me of yours in the sense that it's very much about the stories within the stories of people being affected by a wider system and people who are being dehumanized and their stories erased as a result. So I just wanted to mention that. Okay, so what are three books that you would recommend to our listeners and why those three?
My three books. So to be honest, I actually forgot about this part. So I'm going to try to do it slightly on the fly.
That's fine.
The last book that I read was called A Stricken Field by Marta Gellhorn. And if people are interested in refugee issues, I would recommend that. She was the, I think, the third wife of Ernest Hemingway, but is more better recognized as a war journalist, or briefly a war journalist. And she went to Prague, I think in 1938. And honestly, I was reading this. So now the book is, what, 80 years old, nearly. It was published 1940. And I was reading this and it was just so bleak, because a lot of what she is saying, you can recognize the same dynamics today. And actually, you know, she was like calling for help. Like she describes trying to call for help for these refugees who are themselves like trying to, you know, they're finding their own ways to get by, but they're also being condemned to a lot of suffering. And some of it is about them being pushed back to Germany as well, where they're pretty certain to be sent straight to concentration camps. And it's kind of about appeasement, about the reaction of the rest of Europe and the fact that they just like don't care. And I was thinking about this idea of appeasement, you know, you had it in World War II with Hitler and all of that. But I mean, there's an idea as well now of appeasing the far right, you know, by implementing certain policies. And honestly, I'd recommend that people read it. I'd also be interested to hear what anyone thinks, because I just read it for the first time. So in terms of other books, do you want ones that are specifically about refugee
anything you want, or? Anything you want.
Sorry, I'm just looking up. No, I have a list of things I read recently. I read What Strange Paradise by Omar El-Akkad, which is also a novel. And that's also about migration. But it's about a little boy who arrives on a Greek island. I don't think he names it. And it's kind of like a simple story. It's about a Greek girl who meets this boy and then they try and survive. But again, it's about refugee issues, and he just writes very beautifully, I think. I think he's also a journalist and he writes journalism, but yeah. And then another book, which I also read when I was writing this, but it's, again, sorry, about World War II, was The Volunteer. I don't know if you've heard of it, about it. But that was it's by Jack Fairweather, and I think it won Costa Nonfiction Book of the Year, or maybe the British Book Awards. And it's basically about a Jewish, I think he's Jewish guy, who's a member of the resistance. Sorry, I read this about a year ago, but he's in Auschwitz. And it's kind of about the resistance acts that they did in the concentration camps during World War II. And again, this for me, because I was trying to read about different detention situations. I read also Caroline Elkins. I don't know if you know her books about Kenya and the gulags there under the British. But this one for me, the Jack Fairweather book, he talks about things like, I'm going to get this wrong, but I'm pretty certain they were trying to like reenact revenge on the guards inside Auschwitz. And one of the ways they did that was by getting leeches with typhus in them. I think they got leeches to suck on someone with typhus or something like this. And then they put it in the coats of the SS officers. And that way they managed to give them typhus, and then the SS officers died. And I was reading this and I was like, he details a lot of different things, but I was like, this is just extraordinary in terms of what, you know, what people will do when they're in these very difficult situations in terms of surviving. And one thing that was interesting to me, I think that this happened in The Volunteer, but definitely it happened in Caroline Elkins' book, sorry, and I know that that's a fourth book, but was that the detention, the people locked in detention centers created their own committees as well, where they were trying to, basically make sure to regulate each other so that they didn't anger the guards that were in charge of them. And this was something that happened in Libya in one particular detention center where I was reporting on. And, I actually didn't. I think I read the Caroline Elkins book after I finished my book, but I was reading it and I was like, wow, that's extraordinary, because they basically create the same systems in both to try and again survive. So they create their own rules and they implement the rules on each other so that the guards won't get angry by them breaking rules. And yeah, again, for me, that was, you know, it's like people are amazing. Like they really are capable of, you know, managing in such difficult circumstances. And sorry, the last thing I'll say is just it's not a book, but just to add to that, I mean, I think that that's one of the big mischaracterizations of this, you know, so-called migrant crisis or whatever, is that we haven't been looking at the stories of incredible heroism, like heroism and love. And my book doesn't even look at those particularly, but the stories that I've heard about the bravery of people, the love of people, and the things they do for each other are so amazing. And somehow it's become that we instead are thinking, you know, like you said, swarms of migrants, invasions, like all of this, you know, all of this kind of dehumanizing language. But actually there's another way to look at that, which is about the extraordinariness of people. And yeah, I think maybe hopefully some things will shift in the future.
Amazing. Well, Sally Hayden, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thank you too. Thanks for having me.
The Far East Times is hosted by myself, Joey Ayoub. I am also its producer, researcher, writer, and sound editor. If you want to help turn this project into a full-time job, please head out to patreon.com/firethesetimes to support it. These episodes are part of a bigger project, which includes resources, a newsletter, and eventually YouTube video essays as well. As always, thank you for listening, and take care.